Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. I'm Per Fargrain. A few announcements. There'll be more on the Kennedy assassination this morning. At 10:15, Law and Disorder features an interview with James Douglas, who is the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. So hang around for that. And then tomorrow at 8, I will be back. I'll be hosting Friday Talk Radio. And we'll be talking about the assassination and the many theories about it and inviting your call. So instead of calling today, wait until tomorrow, and we'll have a nice conversation. And then tomorrow night at the First Unitarian Church at 12th, Southwest 12th and Main, there will be Project Unspeakable, a dramatic reading of the, of the book JFK and the Unspeakable. So all those things are coming up. And now we're going to get on to our guest, who is David Talbot. He is the author of a book, Brothers. And he's the founder of Salon.com, and he also wrote an interesting article for Salon about the JFK assassination, saying that the CIA and the New York Times are still lying to us. Well, David Talbot, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Per. Thank you for having me, and thank you to your station for commemorating this major event in American history.
Well, somebody's got to do it. You know, there's a lot of stuff about the assassination, and some of it is pretty awful. I've been listening to it on the radio, and one little theme that seems to be recurring is that Lee Harvey Oswald is a really weird guy, as though that explains, you know, why he supposedly wanted to kill JFK. But seems to me is pretty well known that the CIA makes good use of weird people.
Well, absolutely, and I've been just as outraged by you as the kind of absolute whiteout, I call it, in the media of any alternative history. And, you know, for the last 50 years, there's been a substantial amount of independent research done into the assassination of President Kennedy and into the true identity of Lee Harvey Oswald. And we now know from this very vigorous alternative historical work that's been done that Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, was being closely monitored by the CIA ever since he defected to the Soviet Union in the late 50s. And when he came back to the United States, he continued to be closely monitored by American security agencies, particularly the CIA and FBI. So there's obviously a more interesting, deeper story about Lee Harvey Oswald. We still don't know exactly who or what he was. He yelled out, of course, in the Dallas police station when he was arrested before he was conveniently shot and eliminated. He yelled out to the press, "I'm a patsy." Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the actions of a normal assassin who, you know, a kind of loser like Lee Harvey Oswald has been portrayed, who has this great moment on the historical stage. He usually claims credit for it. He's proud of what he's done. But, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald, till the very end of his life, denied that he was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy.
Well, you know, just when things really looked bleak, I read in today's Oregonian, that's an AP article by David Porter, and the headlines, "Classified JFK Files Ensure Questions Stay Unanswered."
Well, there you go. Now, that's an important story.
Yes, it is.
Finally, you know, hats off to the Oregonian for running that story. I haven't seen that.
Associated Press, David Porter, new name to me, but he writes about how, 50 years after the assassination, a lot of these documents are still being withheld, and he goes into George Ioannidis, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, that's a very important name, and as I say, that's great that they are running the AP story, and David Porter wrote it. The truth, as they used to say, is out there if you have enough time and you seek it out. The source of that story is a good colleague and friend of mine, Jefferson Morley, a former reporter for the Washington Post.
He's mentioned in the story, yes.
That's right. And Jeff, for years when he was at the Post, worked in great frustration trying to get Ben Bradley, the famous executive editor of Watergate fame, and Bob Woodward, the investigative reporter, tried to get him interested in this new information that he was digging up on this fellow named George Joannides. George Joannides is an interesting CIA character, working directly for the very powerful CIA official, Richard Helms. And one of his jobs in the early 1960s was to work with a radical anti-Castro Cuban exile group in Miami called the DRE, the Cuban Student Directorate. And, of course, that group got into an altercation with Lee Harvey Oswald that many people felt was staged on the streets of New Orleans. They were very mixed up in the story of Lee Harvey Oswald, the very shadowy story. And George Joannides then appears 15 years later after the assassination when he's called out of retirement by the CIA to be the liaison between the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the only somewhat legitimate effort by the government to solve the assassination, the congressional committee that was convened in the late 70s. And here the CIA is promising to be completely cooperative with this congressional committee, but at the same time they bring back George Joannides to be the liaison who's providing the documents to the committee. And of course he has his own past connected to Oswald, which he never tells the committee. The chief counsel of that congressional committee later said that if he knew who George Joannides really was at the time, he would not have been working with him. He would have put him on the witness stand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's in this article. Well, you know, it's very kind of mysterious about when Oswald, if he went to Mexico, there's some doubt about that. But you mentioned two books in your article. One is this one by Philip Shannon.
That's right, Shannon.
Yeah.
I think it's Shannon.
Okay, and I don't know. It seems like Oswald apparently took a trip to Mexico City, visited the Soviet embassy and the Cuban embassy, and he had an affair with some lady who worked at the Cuban embassy. He did a lot in 6 days or something like that.
Well, here's the frustrating thing about books like the one by Phil Sheenan. And Phil Sheenan was a respected New York Times investigative reporter. He wrote a very respected book on the 9/11 Commission that was very critical of that. And there was great hopes for his book on the Warren Commission. And to Phil Sheenan's credit, in his new book on the Warren Commission, he does completely expose the commission as a fraud. This was a commission set up by President Johnson not to get at the truth, because the truth, people in high places in Washington really all knew, was too disturbing. So the purpose of the Warren Commission was to put the public spheres to rest and quickly grab on to Lee Harvey Oswald as the only story that they needed to know about, and then case closed. But what Sheenan doesn't do is, after showing the many, many ways that the Warren Commission was manipulated by the CIA and the FBI and the Secret Service, the three security agencies that had so woefully betrayed President Kennedy in Dallas, he doesn't take the next step and go, well, why did the commission get manipulated by these agencies? The agencies clearly had a role to play in the assassination, and Sheenan, like most mainstream reporters, refuses to go there.
Well, he did have one interesting thing that you mentioned in your article, that he reveals how Fidel Castro actually testified to the Warren Commission.
That's right. That is an interesting revelation, and it turned out not to be originally revealed by Sheenan, but another colleague and a friend of mine, Anthony Summers, the great Irish journalist who's been doggedly working in the Kennedy field for many years, to the shame of most American reporters who have been afraid to go there. Anyway, Tony Summers years ago revealed this, that Castro did reach out to the Warren Commission in the middle of their work and said he wanted to meet with them. This was a man who had, of course, been the target of many attempts on his life by the CIA and the mafia, and yet he had the courage to reach out to Washington and say, please, you know, give me a chance to tell my side of the story. Because part of this plot was meant to trigger, I believe, an invasion of Cuba. immediately, when the gunshots were still ringing in Dealey Plaza, the word was put out through CIA assets in the media throughout the world that Lee Harvey Oswald was somehow an agent of either Moscow or Cuba. And I think this was meant to trigger a massive U.S. invasion of Cuba. And so, obviously, Castro wanted to put those fears to rest. The Kennedy family, by the way, did not believe this. Bobby Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy both sent an emissary to Moscow within days of the assassination, assuring them that the Kennedy family did not blame the assassination on the communists, but they believed it was a domestic high-level conspiracy. Bobby Kennedy, who was, of course, the Attorney General of the United States, and this is the subject of my book, Brothers.
I'd like to get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, he was onto this right away. But in any case, Castro wanted to put the fears of the commission to rest, and he did submit to a lengthy interrogation on a yacht off of Cuba. A lawyer for the Warren Commission, William Coleman, who later became Secretary of Transportation, went down there, interviewed him at length. He had met him. He knew him vaguely from the past. They had met in Harlem when they were both young men. And he came back convinced that Castro had nothing to do with the assassination. And, of course, it would have been utter suicide for Fidel Castro to have attempted something like this. His small country would have been blown away by the United States if he had really been involved.
Well, it's a caller called with a question. He mentions, he says that, you know, when Jack Ruby, of course, that's the guy who shot Lee Oswald, his first visitor in jail was a high-ranking mafia leader, and he asks, is that true?
That's absolutely true. And when Bobby Kennedy heard in the Justice Department that Jack Ruby had shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, so he would never be allowed to speak his piece. He immediately, of course, he and his investigators wanted to find out who Jack Ruby was, and I interviewed many people who worked with Robert Kennedy when he was Attorney General in the Justice Department, and they said that after looking at Jack Ruby's phone records, the people he was calling in the days leading up to the events in Dallas, they said it read like the phone records of the witnesses, the mafia witnesses that Bobby Kennedy had called when he was chief counsel for the Rackets Committee in the 1950s in the Senate. So he knew that, you know, this guy was a mobster errand boy. And Bobby Kennedy put this together right away. They weren't fooling Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy knew more about the dark side of America than any other public figure of his day. And he immediately suspected that his brother was the victim of a conspiracy, and that conspiracy came out of the United States government itself, because the CIA was already working, had a lethal assassination operation that it ran in cooperation, in conjunction with the mafia, and they turned that against Fidel Castro, unsuccessfully, of course. He was too well protected, and he had too much intelligence of his own.
Makes you think that maybe there is a God.
But in any case, this lethal CIA operation was brought home to kill the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. And this is what Bobby Kennedy, the top lawman in the country and his brother's devoted ally and protector, this is what Bobby Kennedy believed. And he was himself investigating this crime for the rest of his life till he, too, was killed. And, of course, he was assassinated when he was running for president in 1968, and he was determined to reopen the case the assassination of his brother.
Well, before we get into that, let me say this is Fight the Empire. My guest is David Talbot, who's the author of Brothers and articles on the Kennedy assassination. Well, it's interesting, you know, you talk about how Lee Oswald was kind of named very soon. You know, at the time when the assassination happened, I was working on the copy desk at the San Francisco News Call Bulletin. I'd just been promoted from copy boy to being a copy editor. And, you know, all of a sudden the story started coming in on those old, you know, wire machines. And right away, you know, the name Lee Oswald was mentioned, you know, very quickly. And then one of our reporters who sort of covers urban affairs in San Francisco, the name rang a bell, and he ran into the library of the Clippings Library and came out with a big folder on Oswald's venture in the Soviet Union. And that all happened, it happened very, very fast.
Absolutely. And it was immediately suspicious that he was convicted so quickly, as you say, mm-hmm. in the media, on the wires. The CIA, of course, was very, very wired into the U.S. media. Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA under President Eisenhower and then in the first year of President Kennedy, but then Kennedy fired him after the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, was a bitter enemy of President Kennedy. And, of course, he was very, very connected in the world of the elite media. He was very close to the Sulzberger family that owned the New York Times. He was very close to the heads of CBS and the other networks. And in fact, every year when he was running the CIA, he would throw a CIA party for the media at his favorite club in Washington. I love the name, the Alibi Club. So these guys were all very chummy. Yeah. And we now know from what Carl Bernstein many years ago wrote in Rolling Stone magazine, he did a very important article many years ago. He talked about the hundreds and hundreds of reporters and editors and broadcasters who, if not on the CIA payroll, were CIA assets in one way or another. So it was quite easy for the CIA to manipulate the media coverage of Oswald and the assassination from the very beginning. Unfortunately, 50 years later, you'd expect some of that kind of manipulation, that disinformation machine, to not be quite as widespread. But I must say it's been dismaying, as we said earlier, the kind of almost total blackout of the truth when it comes to the assassination.
Well, years ago, some big CIA guy, I can't think of his name right now, he boasted, I guess, about how so many reporters were sort of assets or whatever, and he said it's like cranking up the mighty Wurlitzer.
That's right. That was their favorite expression for mm-hmm. this great media manipulation machine that the CIA ran out of Langley, the mighty Wurlitzer machine.
But one thing, Frank Wisner, that was a guy, I believe.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, the Oswald's trip to Mexico City made me think of it. Some time ago, Jim DiEugenio wrote an article about two Oswalds, and he had a timeline where when one Oswald is in Russia, working in the factory, this other Oswald is in Miami hanging out with these Cuban exiles. Now, that two Oswald theory has been really put down a lot in the mainstream media. Is there anything to that?
Well, what we can say about Lee Harvey Oswald is that there was an actual physical Lee Harvey Oswald,
right,
who we all know
mm-hmm.
was a young kid from a broken home, grew up under tough circumstances, became a Marine, was stationed at a very interesting base in Japan, the Atsugi Air Force Base, which was an intelligence base. That was where the U-2 spy plane was based. Was given the opportunity to study Russian, which is unusual for just a loser kind of kid at the lower ranks of the military.
And he really picked up on it, too.
And he took to it. He was so Lee Harvey Oswald was a much more intelligent, savvy guy than people have given credit for. But in any case, by the time Lee Harvey Oswald decides to defect to the Soviet Union, in very strange circumstances, the guy at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow who heard him make his statement that day that he was renouncing his citizenship and so on, thought the whole thing seemed staged to him, seemed kind of phony. And whether or not he was acting at that point as a low-level agent being inserted into the Soviet Union, as some people have suspected, he clearly was from then on closely monitored by the CIA. And James Angleton was the very strange guy who was in head of the CIA's counterintelligence unit. And it was the Angleton unit within the CIA that was all over Oswald. Mm. Senator Richard Schweiker from Pennsylvania, who later looked into this for the Church Committee, later said, when you look at Lee Harvey Oswald, you quickly see that, quote, the fingerprints of U.S. intelligence are all over Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the real Oswald, and then there's the file on Oswald, the legend of Oswald, that keeps growing in James Angleton's files at the CIA. That's what I think people are getting at when they say there's two Oswalds.
Mm-hmm.
There was an Oswald who a case was being built around from the moment that the CIA took interest in him to the time he was arrested in Dallas. And, of course, that file, that legend, would lead people to believe not only that he was a Marxist and a dangerous, violent, perhaps psychopath, but that he was acting on the orders of either the Kremlin in Moscow or Fidel Castro in Havana. That's what the CIA, under James Angleton's unit, wanted the public and the media to believe.
And that's what Lyndon Johnson used to sort of persuade Earl Warren to head this commission he didn't want, he's using the story that maybe Castro was behind it, but if we let that out, it means World War III, and he kind of scared the bejesus out of Earl Warren.
That's right. Well, Earl Warren, of course, was a great jurist. He had been governor of California, a progressive Republican.
A DA at one time, too.
That's right. And then he became, of course, was appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme mm-hmm. Court. And under President Eisenhower, he led a historic run of civil rights verdicts that greatly expanded freedom in America. And of course, he was a deeply respected man, hated by the far right, but deeply respected by the Kennedy family and many people throughout the country for his progressive work on the Supreme Court. And he was very, very reluctant to take this job. He knew that the job was a PR job. It was not truly a judicial institution or criminal investigation. It was meant to, as he said, lay the dust on this case and put people's fears to rest. And so imagine a man of that stature being forced to play that kind of public relations role.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very reluctant, as you say, to take on the job. And President Johnson had to scare, as you say, scare hell out of him by saying, if you don't, what could happen, because it was already happening with the CIA disinformation that was starting to spread throughout the media, we could have World War III. And so the whole point of this Warren Commission was not only to knock down the idea of Oswald as a Marxist agent, but to prevent a war from breaking out between the Soviet Union and the United States.
Yeah, let's talk some more about brothers. Now, as you said, Bobby Kennedy, right away he suspected there was some kind of a conspiracy going on. And in your book, Brothers, he plans to eventually run for president and reopen the investigation. But because Lyndon Johnson retired early, I guess Bobby expected him to run for a second term and win, and then Bobby's chance to come in 72. But Johnson bowed out, and Bobby had to move things up to 68. Is that the way it ran?
Yeah, the Bobby Kennedy story is an amazing story. He was, his whole political career was wrapped up with that of his older brother, Jack. He'd run his campaigns. He was a brilliant campaign manager, tough as nails. Then, of course, he reluctantly takes over as attorney general when his brother and his father insist that he play that role in the Kennedy administration. And he's a damn good attorney general. He goes after the mafia more aggressively than any time in American history. He fights for civil rights in the South. And his brother comes under fire more and more from his own national security apparatus, the Pentagon, the CIA, starts giving more and more of even those national security duties to his brother, Bobby. So he depended on Bobby utterly. And when Bobby heard the terrible news and was told to him, by the way, by his arch enemy, J. Edgar Hoover, the reactionary head of the FBI who hated Bobby, he called him up at his home in McLean, Virginia, and he told him in a very cold way that his brother had been shot and later called back and said he was dead. Bobby Kennedy knew from that moment on that his world had broken in two, and his power, of course, was quickly evaporating because the new president was another very passionate enemy of Bobby Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson. So he knew that his power to do anything was quickly evaporating, and yet he wanted to try to get to the bottom of what had happened in Dallas as quickly as he could. So it's a very dramatic story. He sends out his own private investigators for the Justice Department around the country. As I said, they quickly figured out who Jack Ruby was, that he was a mafia errand boy who'd been sent to silence Oswald. Bobby immediately suspected this plot had come out of this lethal alliance between the CIA and the mafia that he felt he had shut down. He'd been finally told about it. This was an alliance that started under President Eisenhower, and Bobby Kennedy didn't find out about it till 1962. But when he did, he was outraged, because the idea that a government agency could be working with organized crime to someone like Bobby, who was a mob hunter, was just outrageous. But he thought he had shut it down. Obviously, it continued, and he suspected that this operation had been turned against his brother. But now he has a dilemma. Does he go public with this information? And as he said to one friend, risk the fact that there could be blood in the American streets because people would be so outraged, the country would fracture in two? Or does he play his cards closely to the vest? Does he try to ultimately get back to the White House to continue his brother's policies and resume what JFK had been trying to do, which was bring about an end to the Cold War and to advance the country on civil rights? And so Bobby decides to do that. That's the way Bobby knew that power worked in America. You had to play it close to the vest. You had to have all your ducks in a row before you took on a conspiracy as powerful as the one that had killed his brother. And so he was determined to get back to the White House. He ran for president, even though it was a very dangerous thing for him to do in 1968. Enormously brave thing for him to do at that point. He had very little security. He had one ex-FBI guy, Bill Berry, mm-hmm. on the campaign trail with him, trying desperately to protect him. He had a couple ex-athletes, Rosie Grier, the L.A. Rams player, and Rafer Johnson, the track star, helping out that night in Los Angeles. He was killed at the Ambassador Hotel.
Of course, the story of that is something really worth talking
about.
That's
a whole other mystery. Kennedy was killed, and of mm-hmm. course, I suspect the same people who killed JFK.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes, but basically, the thing is that Bobby was shot from behind.
That's right.
And Sirhan Sirhan was standing in front of him, kind of firing wildly.
That's right.
So, and the coroner said that day that Bobby was shot from behind. Also, the fact that there were more bullet holes and bullets in Sirhan's gun. But I think we're going to have to leave it right at that. We've been talking with David Talbot, author of Brothers. And one final sort of a yes or no. Do you think we're getting any closer to getting the truth out there? I mean, are we inching towards revealing what's going on or not?
Yes, we are, Per. I have a new book on Alan Dulles, who I think was a central figure in the assassination. And I think the work and Jeff Morley's work at jfkfacts.org, mm-hmm. I suggest people go there. Jim Douglas, you're having him on the air. Another very important mm-hmm. book, JFK, The Unspeakable. So, yes, the truth is getting out.
Hey, try to get a reading up here at Powell's, too.
I will.
Okay, thank you very much. We've been talking with David Talbot, author of Brothers. This is Fight the Empire. Stay tuned, because there will be more Law and Disorder. We'll feature an interview with James Douglas, and then I'll be back tomorrow morning. I'll be doing talk radio, and we can take questions then and go into some more of this. So thank you for listening and stay tuned.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, just a minute before 10 o'clock. Coming up in 15 minutes, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll be airing Law and Disorder, featuring a discussion about how local police departments are expanding mass surveillance and data collection and retention. Also, we'll hear an interview with James Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. At 11 o'clock today on Between the Covers, the guest is local writer Kevin Sempsell about his new novel, This Is Between Us. And at 11:30, we'll hear an interview with creative writing professor Eileen Pollack about her recent article, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? But first, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. You make KBOO possible. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito. among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move you.